Ooh, it's Halloween. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I hear the cat. Kick that little. Anyway, welcome to Aspire for the Halloween version of it as we take a look at some very, shall we say, spooky questions on the subject of fear that I've collected over the past, oh, 2-3 months. And I'm very grateful that you chose to be with us. I just want to remind you very quickly that this radio program and everything that I offer here on the Aspire website is here because of people who have become sponsors, people who see the value of what we're doing and how we are trying to offer to the world an alternative other than religion and philosophy. And I hope that you will become a sponsor and help us sustain. Our mystery donor, who is very kind, will match your sponsorship. If you become a sponsor between now and the end of the year, he will match it. So go to sponsorship. Go take a look. You get the message of the month sent to you, or you can download it from the website at aspire.org, and you will receive a lot of really wonderful little benefits during the year that I send out to my sponsors as a way of thanking them. Make a gift. Do something important. Do something that truly helps humankind and doesn't just inform it of its own evil. Okay? I hope you understand what I just said. All right, let's go. It is Halloween, and I love Halloween. I get a biggest kick out of it because it's a chance to deal with our darkness, our shadow. And in doing so, we get a chance to overcome it. So I'm going to share with you a lot of different things today. I hope that they are of value to you. And I have three very important questions that were given to me. The first one is by Susan, and she lives in Lake Tahoe. Why do I like to be afraid? In a funny kind of way, I go to scary movies and it's comforting. What do you think, Susan? And then she has a little question at the bottom. Am I crazy? Susan, we're all crazy one way or another. Okay, I understand that. I don't want to sound like a moralist here, okay? Because I am far from a moralist. My students would tell you that, and anyone who knew me would tell you that. I am not interested in moral right or wrong. But it is an interesting thing about our unconscious mind and how powerful it is and how it can be influenced by certain things like emotionality, unpleasant emotionality, fear being one of the bigger ones. Now, the word fear, I want to define it here. An unpleasant emotion caused by belief that someone or something is dangerous or likely to cause pain. That's the definition. A feeling of anxiety, okay? So we have our definition straight. I think we like to be afraid because to us, it congregates emotions inside of us more deeply. We enjoy the feeling of inviting an emotion in and showing it its place in our life. Here, sit here. Be here, and be here to frighten me. Be here to alter my mundane mind and the way I think. We use it as a form of, entertainment to augment our thinking. This is very, very, very dangerous because in the unconscious mind, it can go too far, which is what we see, I believe, in people who commit horrendous crimes of going and shooting people in public places, etc., etc. All of this, you know, through the various forms of fear that we have as entertainment, just blows my mind. And how people will pay money to go be frightened is a phenomenon to me that I simply don't understand. I have too much respect for my unconscious mind, and I understand what it can do. I can see it in my dreams. Now, I'm not saying you ought to program your unconscious mind for Mary Poppins either. You know, I mean, you can't, live off of either one of those two things, Mary Poppins or the idea of a Wes Craven kind of movie where people are stabbing each other to death. You have to understand fear's place in us. It's in our DNA. It's a large part of our genetics. And it is there supposedly to help us survive. But now we're in a place where our survival in the case of life and death isn't so much life and death, although that's maybe starting to change here in the Wild West days in which we are living. I feel like the reason you find fear comforting is because you maybe try to find a solution to it. And in the solution is the comfort of being frightened, that maybe there is something more exciting, more tantalizing to your emotionality than maybe, hoping and wishing for something mundane to happen to you. Like maybe you get a piece of apple pie and you think, wow, that's really great. And that's a great reward. But I think some people find the reward being frightened, scared. And it sets off adrenaline. It sets off DNA patterns. The neurons in our brain start firing off. And it feels comforting because you know it's your DNA. Oh, I'm supposed to be afraid. And also, when you go see a frightening movie, you know you can always leave. You know, you kind of get the, you know, I can get up and walk out of here. We like to kind of see what we would do in those situations. And that's kind of where it comes from. But to live in that is not a very good thing. And most of us live in it without knowing that we are doing so. I want to read you something from a book. And if you ever are interested in the kind of dark side and why it's there, this book was just beautiful for me many, many years ago. It's called Meeting the Shadow. Meeting the Shadow. And here's an excerpt from it from Peter Levitt, who is a meditating teacher, a meditator, a Buddhist meditator. At the ritual meal, one takes a few grains of Buddha rice and puts them on the end of a spatula to offer to all the evil spirits for their satisfaction. The servers come by and take a few grains off the spatula, offering them to a plant or an animal, and thus returning them to the cycle of life. This is a way to consciously acknowledge evil spirits of the shadow, to feed them the best food and yet feed them not too much. Later in the day, if one comes across an evil spirit, one can say, "I already fed you. I don't need to feed you again." In the Buddhist tradition, it is believed that there is a realm of hungry ghosts with huge appetites and throats the size of a needle. So they're never satisfied, like the shadow with its ravenous appetite. By feeding it in small, regular amounts, the shadow doesn't need to take on a devouring attitude. We know that we can't stimulate the realm of the hungry ghosts, and we know we can't eliminate them either. They exist, so we have to take care of them. Then the effort of their grumbling will be less, and so it is with the shadow. I love that quote. It's fun. It's playful. If you notice, there's a playfulness to it, and I love Buddhists for their playfulness. I love their simplicity, their innocence. But there you are. I think it's a great way of looking at it. You know, you just can't live in it all the time. And if you do, it's killing your life. It really is. So I say to you, Susan, if you find it comforting, what can I say to you? You're not going to do what I ask you to do, which is stay away from them and focus on concentrating your energies upon the way of the heart. I know you're not, and you know you're not. So if you're going to entertain this kind of thing and undermine your own life, you might as well give it a few grains of rice here and there and see what happens. And maybe, just maybe, something might come out of that. Something, oh, something playful. Oh, I'm back. Something a little more, well, shall we say spiritual, meaning that I acknowledge what I'm afraid of. I acknowledge the fear, and I'm not going to deny that it exists, but I'm also not going to feed it either. Because once we feed that little puppy, oh, it gets more than unpleasant, and it can really take over a person's life. Typically, and I say this typically, we are obsessed with fear. We use it as a way to give us boundaries, and we use it as a way to give us, what shall I say, thought and entertainment. It's a pathetic way of living our life, but we've all done it one way or another, I think, and it comes naturally from our DNA. The object of an authentic spiritual practice is to transcend DNA and not to fight it, but to see love and whatever is important to love, to make love more powerful than anything you've ever known in your life. Not likely, but please forgive me. Namaste. I don't think people are much into that. I know I'm talking to the wind half the time, more than half the time. I know. Next one comes from Pete in Las Vegas, Nevada. We get a lot of listeners from Vegas. I am surprised. Fear makes people strong, from Pete. So be afraid and be strong, Pete. Pete, I don't know how old you are. I don't know if you're a young person or a middle-aged person or whatever you are. But fear does not make us strong. Only love dispels hate. Hate never yet dispelled hate. And hate is the offspring of fear. Only love dispels hate. We live in a culture that admires fear, that admires what makes us afraid. Now, we all have fear. I have fear. Everyone does. How we face it, how we deal with it is very important. And I think, I want to believe this, I could be wrong, this is what you mean, that fear makes us strong if we overcome it, if we see through it, if we understand the nature of it. That I would agree with totally and completely. But to just have fear as a way to muster up more emotional courage, that would not be so good. And that's what most people do. They think they can be strong through emotionality. It is our emotions that are our downfall. It is our emotions that make us, shall we say, less than. It is in emotionality that we turn to the idea that love is emotion. So if I do love is emotion, fear is also a basic urge, a basic premise of human life. And it also becomes emotion because we're afraid we won't survive. We're afraid we can't control our survival. And that's what fear is all about. That's the nature of it. Then fear is a part of my emotionality too. So now do we fight love and fear within us? Yes. People want to say, if you ask someone, which are you, love or fear? I think some people would probably say I'm love because that's what they believe emotionally. And other people would say I'm a combination of both, which would probably be more accurate. And other people would say I am just fear. I know people who are petrified about everything. It doesn't matter what it is, they're petrified and frightened of everything. So I understand the whole thing that we're talking about here. But there has to come a time where somewhere in the middle of your lifetime, you get tired of being afraid. Afraid of whatever. Whatever this is, whatever that is. And facing our fears, what does that mean? Does it mean we confront them like people believe? Maybe you can find the answer in a little story. Zen Flesh, Zen Bones. I love this story. I try to read it to my students every year, one way or the other, and this is that time. A young wife fell sick and was about to die. "I love you so much," she told her husband. "I don't want you to leave, and I don't want you to leave me either. Do not go from me to marry another woman after I die. If you do, I will return as a ghost and cause you endless trouble." Some love she offered, huh? Soon the wife did pass away. The husband respected her last wishes for the first 3 months, but then met another woman, and it is said that he fell in love with her, and they became engaged to be married. Typical. Life moves on. Immediately after the engagement, a ghost appeared every night to the man, blaming him for not keeping his promise. The ghost was clever, too. She told him exactly what had transpired between himself and his new sweetheart. And whenever he gave his fiancée a present, the ghost would describe it in nauseating detail. She would even repeat conversations, and it annoyed the man so that he could not sleep at night. Someone advised him to go take the problem to a Zen master who lived close to the village. So he did, and he talked about it. "Your former wife became a ghost and knows everything you do," said the master. "Whatever you do or say, whatever you give your beloved, she knows, huh? She must be a very smart ghost, very smart. Really, you should admire such a ghost. The next time she appears, bring something with you. Tell her that if she knows so much, you can hide nothing from her. And if the answer to your question is yes, then promise that if she cannot answer this one question, she will leave you alone forever." The master said, "Take a large handful of soybeans. The next time she appears, and ask her exactly how many beans you hold in your hand. If she cannot tell you, you will know she's only a figment of your imagination and will trouble you no longer." Well, the next night when the ghost appeared, the man flattered her and told her that she knew everything. "Indeed," replied the ghost, "and I know you went to see that Zen master today. And since you know so much," demanded the man, "tell me, how many beans do I hold in my hand?" There was no longer any ghost to answer the question. I love that story. I love the playfulness of Zen, and it's so much fun. Well, you could see that it was all in the head. So if he thought that there was 12 beans there, of course the ghost would have known. But since he didn't know, hence the ghost couldn't know. That's the way fear works. We use fear as a ghost, and it taunts us, and it answers our questions, and it appeals to our emotional nature. And frankly, a lot of people's emotional nature is ruthless and unkind, uncaring. So a lot of ugly things happen. It's really sad, but true. And this is what we do with our life. We make it sad, but true. If you're going to overcome a fear, overcome it through dropping emotionality. Learn what your emotions are all about, how they congregate, how they create separate entities and personalities within us. And be aware that the more that they congregate within you in little prejudice forms here and there, watch how your intellect starts sinking deeper and deeper into them, vivifying them, verifying them, making excuses for them. And pretty soon you will see the downfall of your own mind if you are wise, and you will stop it. You won't go there anymore. But what can I say to you? Most people love to go there. They love to go into their fear and their mind succumbs to it, and pretty soon the emotions overcome your intellectual prowess, your ability to section off emotions and know this emotion from that emotion and the reality that does not exist in any emotion. And pretty soon you're sunk if you're not careful. So I say to you, if you're going to use fear as a way to become fearless, then don't be afraid of what you think you're afraid of. Start delving into the fear of it all and what constitutes fear, what makes up fear. If you do that, Pete, you're going to find, the key to everything. And you're going to have to live your life from a different premise. And that premise will be kindness, compassion, everything that is the opposite of our fears. Something for you to think about, my dear friend. Please forgive me. Namaste. Interesting how we think we can overcome fear with fear, fire with fire, hate never yet dispelled hate, yet we insist upon it. Last question comes from Carol, doesn't tell me where she lives. We die. There is nothing I can do about dying. So I guess the best way to live is and overcome my fear of death is to live and let the pieces fall where they may. Carol. Oh, Carol. This is a kind of fatalistic point of view. It is true we all die. I won't be here one day and you won't be there one day. It is true. But to just let the pieces fall where they may, without any effort towards love, seems a bit foolish to me. I don't want to leave the way I came. And I don't want to be what I used to be. And learning not to hate and fear what I used to be is the key to leaving in a more gracious and loving manner. People are what they are. And some of them can help it and most of them can't. But I say don't let the pieces fall where they may. They're going to. I know what you're saying. But maybe it would be good to let the pieces fall in another way. Instead of for hate and fear and selfishness and pride, that we deeply allow everything to happen just the way it needs to happen under the auspice of a great love that you have cultivated through consciousness, through meditation. Maybe just allowing the human to be human and the divine to be divine within us might be exactly that middle way that we are to walk as both the Buddha and Jesus talked about. It can happen that way. It really can. I think taking a fatalistic point of view about our death doesn't achieve anything in our life. It doesn't bring forth anything meaningful. It just is that fatalistic point of view that most people have. Oh, what the hell? Can't do anything about it. Might as well join them. If you can't beat them, join them. I say, no. Let love live you. Make love that achieves a sense of consciousness. Make it a chance, a beauty, an opportunity, a blessing. Make love first in your life. Make it something that you revolve your life around rather than the fatalistic point of view. Well, what does anything matter? We're going to die anyway. That doesn't achieve anything. That doesn't bring forth anything noble or virtuous in you. That way you can just rationalize your evil and say there's no reason to try to do anything in this world because we're all going to die and it all goes back to, you know, the way it was anyway. It does and it doesn't. You can make a difference in little ways. In little beautiful ways you can make a difference in this world. Being kind. A small gesture. Putting your hand on the back of a person that you're trying to help. Just a caring touch means so much. And if you are that way, if you can be that loving, that kind, you can change everything. Kindness is a very potent experience. And it has a way of seeping into those little places inside of all of us that are hardened by our fears and our angers. So, yes, we will die, all of us. But before we die, let there be life. Let there be love. Give love into every situation. Please forgive me. Namaste. Well, you have a happy Halloween tonight, and may all of this that I just gave you be a small consideration in your life. Please forgive me, eh? Namaste.